This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre is accusing a national broadcaster of unfair news coverage as part of an effort to help the Liberals. Now, we've heard that before about the CBC, but this time it's CTV. CTV has apologized for taking Poilievre out of context. Now, this happened in a report in which comments that Poilievre made were edited together to create a sentence he did not say, and the out-of-context comments suggested the non-confidence motion that Poilievre tabled in Parliament was all about dental care as opposed to a long list of issues the Conservative pose, including the carbon tax.
Questions about trust in the media have clearly escalated in Canada in recent months. Indeed, with each error or questionable tweet, there is seemingly an inevitable chorus of concerns that raise doubts about the implications of government regulation and funding of the media. That chorus had been growing with various funding initiatives, but seems to have reached a new level with Bill C-18, the Online News Act. So where is the Online News Act at right now? What of the new collective designed to distribute the $100 million that Google agreed to pay in return for an exemption from mandated arbitration? And what can be done about this mounting trust deficit? Aaron Miller wears several hats, including as the CEO and co-founder of IndyGraph, and she's the interim board chair of the Canadian Journalism Collective, the collective that was picked by Google to administer the $100 million. She joins the podcast in a personal capacity. She isn't speaking on anyone's behalf to talk about the latest Bill C-18 developments and what measures might help address trust in Canadian media. Aaron, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining. You know, a year ago or so at this time, I guess last September, those following the aftermath of Bill C-18, the Online News Act, were focused on some of the proposed regulations. I think the government had put them out at that point in time, and it's pretty clear that at that time, Google wasn't particularly enamored with them, and they indicated some of their opposition. We're dealing with the blocked links on Meta platforms. And so the bill had passed, but there were still a lot of questions. A year later, we have some of the answers. The regulations, of course, have been finalized. There's the $100 million deal with Google. We also have had now more than a year of blocked links on Facebook and Instagram. But I think it's fair to say there are a lot more questions as well. And so I'd like to use this podcast to explore both the implementation of Bill C-18, as well as some of the broader questions that I think have really been increasing around trust in the media and the impact of all of the government support. To start, can you tell us where we are at with respect to implementation of Bill C-18?
Sure, I'm happy to. Before I jump in, though, I just want to clarify that I'm not able to speak on behalf of the CJC today. I'm happy to talk about, with my hat on, as CEO of IndyGraph and director of Discourse Community Publishing, so a news business ourselves, and happy to also talk about what the CJC has put on the public record, which is pretty much everything. So there's nothing to hide by any means, but I just do want to be clear that I can't speak on behalf of the board or the organization itself today. In June, Google selected the Canadian Journalism Collective to distribute the $100 million in funding. So they had held an open RFP with some principles around governance and representation, and then selected the Canadian Journalism Collective on that basis. That kicked off a CRTC public consultation, and the consultation's looking at whether Google has met its requirements as outlined in the regulations to get an exemption from the Online News Act. That consultation is now closed, and we're just awaiting the CRTC's decision, and they may decide to issue a full exemption to Google. The period of time that was contemplated for that was 5 years. They could also issue a interim exemption if they find that there are still some pieces of the puzzle that aren't yet in place to meet the requirements. And have conditions attached to that, or they may reject the exemption application outright. That said, the vast majority of the submissions to the CRTC called on them to issue some kind of exemption, and so we're hopeful that that will happen. And in the meantime, the CJC has just been working hard to set up shop. It's a new nonprofit. There's a lot of work to do to put it in place. They're based in Ottawa, have a small team now. Governance structure and bylaws are all in development, and ultimately just readying itself to be able to distribute that funding as soon as possible following the CRTC decision. So if
Okay.
all goes well, money will be flowing to newsrooms by the end of this calendar year. That's what they've committed to.
Okay, interesting. So I want to unpack a couple of things there. And just so and to make sure that listeners are aware of even what this exemption process is all about. So fundamentally, perhaps we could just explain that. I mean, for those that know the bill, they'll know that this is all about Google sort of meeting its legislative requirements by way of exemption, and the $100 million was the way to do that. Can you just expand a little bit just on what that process and then the kind of different options that you just highlighted that the CRTC has in terms of its decision as to whether or not to grant that exemption?
Sure. So under the regulations, Google has has an option to instead of going and cutting individual deals with media organizations to select a single collective that takes on that role. And so that was the option that they met. And then it describes in the act or in the regulations specifically what news businesses need to be compensated through this deal in order to meet that exemption. So there's language in there, and I'm not going to be comprehensive here, but there's language in there about ensuring that that it is a substantial group of the Indigenous news organizations. They talk about local news. They want to see both for-profit and nonprofit in there. So there is a bar. There's a lot in there about official minority languages. So there really is a bar, a fairly high bar that's set for the how representative the deal that distributes this money needs to be. And that's an important differentiator from the legislation that came out of Australia. Because essentially what happened there was that Google and Facebook could just go and cut a few deals with a few a small number of large media organizations without having to treat the smaller independent organizations equitably. So that's built right into the law here and is definitely an improvement. So that's what the CRTC is looking at, is like, does this deal meet the requirements that were laid out in those regulations?
You mentioned off the top, you're involved with this collective, but don't speak for it. You're speaking in independent capacity, which is great. Now, when the collective reached agreement with Google, I think it was back in June, there was a fair amount of opposition, I think it's fair to say, certainly from some of the competitors that the collective faced. What changes or alterations did the collective make, if any, in response to some of those concerns? Or is that when you mentioned working on things like bylaws and stuff like that, is that effectively the response to get up and running?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess I'll just start that, like, in terms of my response to the pushback that happened when the CJC was announced as having won the Google bid. And I mean, bottom line is, like, no one likes to lose a competition. And so I think the CJC being selected did come as a surprise to some folks. And the response was honestly more vicious than I expected. However, with all of that aside, the reality is that $100 million a year getting put into the Canadian news ecosystem, it's a lot of money. It has a potential to really move the needle. And so I think it's appropriate that the group that's tasked with distributing it would come under a lot of scrutiny. And so that piece of it is certainly welcome in the industry. My position has been from the beginning that and I say this, I say the same thing to IndieGraph's publishing partners in California, where Google has recently signed another deal with government there, is that if we can figure out how to align with the sector in our negotiations with government and big tech, that actually puts us in a much stronger position if we can come together as an industry. That's what I'd really, that's what we're working towards here in Canada. In terms of how the CJC has responded to that criticism, I think it's done a good job of staying really focused on the work. It is a serious job to set up what is a $500 million over 5 year fund in a very short period of time. Like, we heard very clearly through the CRTC submissions just how much this money is needed by news organizations. And so the CJC takes that really seriously and is just really focused on that. And You know, there was 83 submissions to the consultation, I believe, and the CJC's team, you know, carefully reviewed all of those, considered all of them. You know, that does require weighing some competing perspectives between different kinds of businesses and different kinds of organizations against the objectives of the act and what's in the regulations, and to figure out the best way to do this, the most efficient way that benefits the industry and ultimately delivers on the promise of the act. So they're taking that work really seriously. Definitely a lot of the perspectives that were brought forward by both, like, the, you know, the news lobbying organizations like News Media Canada and the CAB were considered and weighed, and decisions were made that were in response to those things. They didn't get all their way by any means either, because they're, you know, the CJC is also committed to centering the needs of small independent local news businesses too. And but I think the responses they're working towards are very reasonable. And what we're seeing is that as more and more of the actual work, the policies, the eligibility criteria, you know, the process for this is put on the public record, the CJC has been just earning credibility with different stakeholders. So we've seen a lot of the criticism quiet down. So I'm quite hopeful that there's still an opportunity for for some new alliances to be built in the industry, and that we're starting to have some more positive conversations.
Okay, you mentioned that all being well, the hope is to ensure that the first tranche, that first 100 million, and you mentioned you're expecting this to be 5-year deal, so we're talking about $500 million collectively, but 100 million in the first year, hoping to see that go out by the end of the year. Can you talk a little bit about what this is going to look like in practice? You know, let's say CRTC comes back this week with a decision and sort of gives the green light. You know, what comes next to meet that hoped for deadline of getting the money out by the end of the year?
Yeah, sure. So it will largely come down to what the CRTC decision is. It's not really a A or B type thing, because there likely will be conditions involved. So interpreting that decision will really have a large influence. In the meantime, the CJC has just been, you know, moving ahead as quickly as possible, in good faith, putting pieces into place and hoping that the governance and the policies will work with whatever the conditions are that come out. Of course, if an interim exemption is the decision, then Google has said very clearly, in its submissions, that it wouldn't flow funding on that basis, that it wants a full exemption. So there is a little bit of uncertainty there. And I don't know anything other than what's on the public record in that. So I do think there's a little bit of uncertainty there that we should be watching really closely. If we do get an exemption, whether interim or full, and Google moves forward with the funding, then the funding will flow within 60 days of receiving the exemption. And the CJC will be circulating an application for news businesses to become members within the next week or so. We're not waiting for the exemption for that, because we want to have the membership organization as much of the work done before the money flows so that we can turn it around as quickly as possible. So yeah, so we'll be admitting members, putting the governance into place, which involves putting a board in place, including a council of broadcasters and a council of publishers who can assess the applications to ensure that the eligibility is there, and then admit folks in. All of that is on the basis of, I don't know if I'm getting too in the weeds of the execution of this thing, but everyone will have to sign an attestation and provide information about how many journalists they employ and how much budget they spend on freelance. That will allow us to determine through the formula that's also on the public record, how much money goes to each news business and distribute that quickly. We have an auditing firm or a accounting firm that will spot check you know, look and do some assessment afterwards, but the money will flow on the basis of the attestations. Of course, there's a whole dispute resolution process and a process for dealing with sort of edge cases or businesses that are not eligible that believe they are, so that they can resolve any disputes about that. So, but that's not going to hold up the funding, the first tranche of funding flowing. Because we just know how important it is for everybody for these funds to get out into the industry and onto the ground in Canadian communities.
Okay, I mean that's a really helpful breakdown of some of the things to watch for over the coming months. depending on what comes out of the CRTC. Why don't we go sort of go a little higher level in terms of taking a look at the bill itself and some of the impact that it's had, recognizing obviously that, you know, one of the biggest impacts will be some of this money once it comes forward. Even with this deal, you know, we've seen media closures, layoffs, we've seen mergers. Some of the proponents of the legislation lobbied very vocally for it, now seem to acknowledge that the bill hasn't worked out as hoped. What do you make of the impact of Bill C-18, specifically in this instance, from a pure economic perspective in terms of what is done or not done for the industry?
Sure. Well, I don't think you can gloss over the fact that Meta's decision to block Canadian news destroyed a ton of value for publishers. Whether or not news organizations' bottom line is going to be better off once these Google funds flow without Meta or not, I think that remains to be seen. But there's certainly news businesses who I've spoken to that don't believe that even with the $100 million, think that we're worse off just from a pure economic bottom line perspective, with Meta having left. But I mean, the other thing too, again, like I've got a little bit different of a perspective here, because IndieGraph's work is focused across North America, and most of the publishers that we work with are actually in the US. And what we're seeing there is that Meta is pulling back news as well, like that traffic, it's not worth what it was a few years ago. And so I think that we need to keep that in mind too. It was so painful in Canada because it happened so suddenly and it was quite unpredictable, or a lot of folks didn't see it coming. We really thought that there would be a last minute negotiation, or that Facebook was bluffing or something. So I think the bottom line is here that as news organizations, like, we really do need to build sustainable businesses on the basis of direct relationships and own channels with the audiences that we serve and provide that value. And we can't, we can't have these businesses that are overly reliant on a third party technology platform that doesn't have, you know, the same incentives and the same interests in mind as we do. And so that doesn't change either way.
Speaking of reliance, one of the real concerns actually has been independence of the press and reliance on government. And we've seen this issue of the independence of the press become a major talking point. I think it probably was before C-18, but that's really only grown, I think, since the legislation passed. We saw it just in the last few weeks. There was the Tlaib Noor Mohammed tweet, which some took to be almost a threatening type tweet, or at least illustrative of some of the risks that arise when you've got government funding. And then, of course, more recently, controversy over a CTV News report that involved pulling together bits of Pierre Poilievre. It seems to me whenever these mistakes now happen, or errors happen, however you want to characterize it, immediately people start thinking about the financial support that the government is providing to media and the impact that it has on independence. So what's your view? What do you think government funding has meant with respect to some of that independence with respect to media coverage?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think this is a worry to be glossed over. This is a real issue. Of course, we've seen trust in media and trust in institutions more broadly decline in a pretty frightening way in the last few years. And I mean, I guess what I would say first is that the vast majority of journalists, working journalists for these organizations, are committed to these principles of independence. You know, journalism isn't even just a job. It's like a worldview. It's an identity. I still, you know, even though I'm on the business side and have been for several years now, I still feel that really, really strongly. And most journalists really are committed to that over any partisan or other issue. And they're doing great work. So that's, 99% of it. However, it is really concerning, some of the messaging that we're seeing emerge and the concerns that that people have about government funding. And I do really think that it plays clearly into the hand of the messaging we've seen Poilievre put forward recently about, you know, Trudeau censorship. I saw in a fundraising memo that, you know, the Trudeau censored media and that type of thing. You know, this is directly out of the fake news playbook that we see in the US as well. So we don't want to overlook that. I think as news organizations, what we need to be doing is really acknowledging that a truly independent press is one that is built on an independent business model that isn't overly reliant on government funding. And you know, when you look at governments that have fascist leaders, what's the thing that they do first is they shut down the media, right? Like there's a reason for that. So if we do want a truly independent media, it needs to be able to stand on its own 2 feet. So I do worry about the impact on trust from having so much government subsidy that's involved in our media organization.
Okay. And that trust is a huge issue. You know, it seems to me that, you know, notwithstanding C18 and some of the money that generated coming out of that, and we of course talked about some of the losses as well, it's not as if the campaign for support has ended. In fact, if anything, it sometimes feels like it's accelerated. More requests or lobbying for more tax credits, you know, alongside C18, we saw an expansion of the labor journalism tax credit. We've seen change in policies in terms of advertising spending. And so if anything, we've seen a continued shift, even more to increased reliance on government and government policy. You know, is there an end to this, do you think? And in some ways, does success in terms of generating some government support invariably lead to yet more lobbying for yet more money? And then the cycle continues and the concerns that you just highlighted around trust continue to grow.
Yeah, I mean, I think as news organizations that are, you know, independent small businesses, like if we look at what is working in this country and what is growing, these are small businesses, a lot of them small chains that are, you know, privately held or independent, you know, one-off shops that function more like small businesses than they do like, you know, large corporate organizations with lobbying. And I think that's what we really need to focus on is building these businesses and building trust at that community level and ensuring that the incentive systems are right, like so that we ultimately exist to serve community members, to do that public service piece. And we communicate that and we make decisions that are aligned with that. And that we're educating people about that rather than, you know, some of the really large organizations where the incentive systems are different, right? Where ultimately a hedge fund in the US owns our local media. So I think the answer here really is about building strong businesses. And that small business piece is understood by communities when you are showing up and on the ground and, you know, not just doing the accountability journalism, although that's very important, but also being part of those communities to celebrate wins and, you know, to mourn with communities when things are happening and to be part of that culture of a community. I think that's where you build trust is really at that local level. And the independent businesses are really well positioned to do that. So, you know, your question was, does more money invariably, you know, lead to more lobbying? And, you know, I really worry about taking apart what, the subsidy programs that we put in place, because I know that our media really is very reliant on it right now. I hope that it doesn't happen in a way that's really, really, you know, like ripping the Band-Aid off, because I think that would be, yeah, just terrible for communities. However, I'm certainly would like to see us use this government funding to build sustainable businesses so that we don't need it. Because ultimately, a really healthy ecosystem doesn't need to rely on this government funding. And we know there are trade-offs with trust.
Yeah, so I appreciate the value in education and communication, especially at the local level. But I do wonder, you know, do you think the public will be able to really separate out sort of even that message that may be coming from some local businesses or local media with sort of the larger national players that are the ones that are often the ones engaged in some of the political coverage. And, you know, as we, you mentioned some of the Polyev positioning with respect to the media, we're going to have an election sometime likely in the next year, you know, and it seems to me that a lot of the coverage, no matter what you do, if you're critical of Polyev, there are going to be those that are going to say, well, some are doing that precisely because they want to see the existing government policy and support mechanisms continue. You know, how do we separate out some of that messaging, or even more, can we separate out that messaging from what people's, in many ways, increasingly preconceived notions are about what some of these larger players, or the motivations of what some of those larger players happen to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one thing that the media loves to report on the media, we are navel gazers for sure. And I think the truth is that that a lot of this lobbying and the stories about the media business, like, actually don't resonate all that much with the public, and they're not following it that closely. I think where they are getting that message is through the political discourse. So when we see, Polyev's messaging that I mentioned from that. So I don't know that folks really notice it that much in terms of separating out messaging. Like, I don't think we need to separate out messaging. What the research shows us about local news is that the more national and international news that we consume, and the less local news, so the more of the share of our attention goes towards national and international, the more polarized we get. And that folks who live in community that don't have reliable access to that local news, they're less likely to vote, to volunteer, they're more polarized, they are less likely to even trust their neighbors. But even just by local news being there, quality local news being present, being something that you can find and you can trust, really increases voter turnout, it increases volunteerism. Like, it really is the fabric of our communities. And so, so I don't know that it's a problem of messaging so much as it is, it's just like, we need boots on the ground there to show up and to build these relationships with people. And when we do have access to that as community members, like, we can find common ground across the table, even if we have differences politically. So that's essentially what I've been betting my career on, is building, you know, sustainable models to do that within local communities. But it is very distinct from what's happening in the national, in the national space. And I think obviously it's going to be the national and, like, larger corporate media that are going to, you know, do the lobbying. Right. But I don't know that messaging is what most Canadians are really paying attention to.
Right. You know, why don't we close with this? And I think that's a compelling argument for certainly the value and the importance that local media has, and particularly the independent media that we see in so many different communities. You know, we can see the benefits that can then accrue to some of those organizations from some of the support. But, you know, you've mentioned at least a couple of times about the importance ultimately of building sustainable businesses. Are there measures, do you think, that are available, say, from government or elsewhere, that may still help the sector that don't come with some of the downside risks that we've also been able to identify? So are there things that can help get to that point of sustainability that don't at the same time raise some of the kinds of concerns around media independence and trust and the like?
There are great examples. And I feel like some of the work that's been done around procurement policies is really positive. So, you know, we see this in New York State, where there is a requirement to spend a certain amount of the media and advertising budget on local news. And that just makes sense as a policy. You're getting value. That's a business decision. And actually, we just had a similar policy pass in Ontario here. So I'm really a big fan of governments making decisions to use some of their direct some of their spending towards local news, because that's a decision that's not only going to, you know, ultimately deliver them value in terms of reaching audiences with the public service messaging that they want to get out about healthcare or you know what have you, but it also strengthens those information networks, that information fabric that is required for us to function, you know, productively as communities and society. So that I'm certainly a fan of. I think there have been examples of funds that are put into place to de-risk for private investment, different kinds of economic activity that we want to incentivize, and that work, right? You know, we've seen a lot of efforts, for example, around green innovation, for example, where we really want to develop IP within our country and create jobs within our country around innovation, but it's highly risky. And so, you know, the government has put funds into place where they assess business opportunities and will support some funding that ultimately unlocks investment. So, you know, I'm building a startup with IndieGraph currently. And one of the reasons that, you know, even though most of our customer base is in the US and, you know, we keep the business, most of the employees in Canada. And why is that? That's in part because we've been able to benefit from the environment here that the government has put into place, different tax credits and things like that, that incentivize us to build IP in Canada and to hire, you know, software developers here and those types of things. So, I mean, I guess what I would say is what I don't love is creating an environment in which the government is an essential part of the operating model of media. However, if we can have some catalytic funding at certain points to incentivize investment, that's where I'm more interested. That's where I feel like those are stronger strategies, and are things that we've already done and we know how to do from other industries. There's a basis there to look at. Yeah, I think the one part of the story that doesn't get told as much here too, that I should have mentioned earlier when you asked about the impact of C18, is I don't think we can ignore that just the impact of chilling the investment environment by creating that uncertainty within the ecosystem. If you look at the local news project led by April Lindgren at TMU, you see that there was, you know, dozens of new businesses being launched, new local news businesses being launched year after year, up until this law passed. And then the last 2 years, it's been like one business a year. Like the chart tells that story. And it's because we really just saw, you know, everybody just put a hold on making any investment. And those are the sorts of things that we need to think about, because even if the government wants to, you know, subsidize 100% of it by, you know, doing CBCs for everything, that's not going to be enough. It's not going to be enough to actually meet the need. And so we do need this to build these as independent businesses.
Okay. You know what? I think that's a great place to leave it. The emphasis on innovation and investment, as opposed to the kind of subsidy model that has been so much the focus of recent policy. And Aaron, thanks so much for taking the time to talk about all this fast moving area on the podcast.
Thanks, Michael. It was a pleasure.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.